The following is an excerpt from Mark Nepo's book, Inside the Miracle, Enduring Suffering, Approaching Wholeness. Who will live your life? This is what the great choice comes down to, the great conflict between first-hand experience and tradition, between spontaneity and decorum, between compassion and obligation. Other life forms have no part in this. It's strictly a human affair. The sapling doesn't look to its elders for approval. It just grows towards the light. The bee feels its hunger and finds its honey. It doesn't embark out of any sense of duty. When I speak of these things, distrustful minds, against all intention of getting involved, blurt out, "But we have to live in the real world." After a long silence, I offer, "You must meet the outer world with your inner world, or existence will crush you." And so it begins, continues, ensues. Who will live your life? The answer is obvious. Yet the difficulty is not in knowing the course, but in accepting the many ways we give our life away. Accepting the many ways we abdicate the one outright gift we have. Too often, we're told that to live in the real world, we must give up our dreams in service of a survival that looms as pragmatic. In truth, it's the opposite. Living in the world in a real way requires the evolution of an interior life, and much of our health depends on how we, at our poorest best, negotiate the infiltration of outer and the release of inner. Kabir, the great mystic poet of India, suggests that the soul is merely a portion of ocean gathered in our pitcher of life. Take a pitcher full of water and set it down on the water. Now it has water inside and water outside. We mustn't give it a name, lest silly people start talking again about the body and the soul. When we tend our soul, we tend to our portion of ocean. When we give complete attention to our portion of God's being, we take up space and emanate the depths of our original energy. It's how we shine within. And at the edge, where the individual soul meets the world, where the pitcher meets the ocean, where inner light meets outer light, there is a kinetic border we can't resist, a rim called wonder that draws us back into the whole. But out of fear or pressure, or both, we often remove ourselves from life in order to handle situations. How often do we steel our feelings in order to act objectively? How often do lovers remove themselves from their field of intimacy in order to leave a relationship? How often do we inwardly sever our bond to a dear one who is ill, long before they're gone, to enable us to move on without the pain of losing them? How often do we minimize the life before us so we can more easily do what we want? We also stop living our own life when we succumb to the judgment and rejection of others. If you haven't encountered it yet, you'll surely be faced with the pressure of someone demanding more than you can safely give without damaging your soul. Whether that someone is a needy friend, an arrogant boss, an inexorable religion, or a perfectionist brand of self-justification, it all comes down to how each of us dares to say no when asked to be other than who we are. And the violent speed of our age doesn't help. In a world so mobile and transient, we can wake up married in Atlanta and go to sleep divorced in Fort Worth. The game has become who can snatch a mouthful of seed and be on their way first. In a world where sophistication means we show nothing, the mind becomes as cold as a camera shutter, opening and closing rapidly so as not to let too much in. In a world that makes a fortress of objectivity, we avoid the one frontier that returns us to first-hand experience, our ability to care. In a world that deems simplicity as dull, patience as slothful, and compassion as entangling, we give up inroads to our very core if we can no longer empathize. Succumbing to speed is a form of isolation that makes us feel inadequate, because we're always falling short, always catching up. But stopping alone is not entering stillness, because stopping alone does not let who we are merge with where we are. Still, to stop and slow down is a beginning, because we start to find what matters when we stop rushing. Rushing can be defined as any instance in which we move faster than we need to. As soon as we begin to rush, whether hurried by an overbearing parent to the dinner table, or harried into a career choice by an artificial deadline of our own making, we become estranged from ourselves. That is, a hollow forms between our inner self and the self that's rushing through the world. Once divided from our sense of aliveness, we lose contact with that kinetic border called wonder. This estrangement from our aliveness is the beginning of alienation. And though there are many ways to feed our estrangement, rushing out of congruence, out of being where we are, is as sure a path as any to the netherworld of half-living. If I learned anything from having cancer, it's that unless there's a physical need, such as needing air to breathe or needing to stop a wound from bleeding, there's no reason to rush, no matter the level of urgency being showered on us by others. Each of us is driving our own train, and the trick is not to go so fast that everything blurs, and yet to go steadily enough that we get somewhere, though there are times when not going at all is tantamount to arriving. So who will live your life? Who will you dare entrust that to? Even when the Japanese poet Kikaku says, "A blind child, guided by his mother, admires the cherry blossoms," the child does not relinquish the chance to admire the blossoms directly. It seems the deepest love can guide or even lead, but then removes itself as if it had never been there at all. Such a mother barely touches her blind child's arm. Now the child can't tell if the path to the garden was their mother's wind-like guidance or the nudging of their own intuition. This is the gift of love. Yet too often, we impose by giving what we so sorely need or never received, and then the child is made a puppet of the giver's pain. When giving like this, we're driven by our estrangement, hiding from the world while trying to expose ourselves through others. But who knows what a blind child sees when looking at blossoms? Who knows what anyone sees from the privacy of their own blindness? And make no mistake, each of us is blind in a particular way, as each of us has a unique sense of sight. In effect, each of our fears blinds us to a particular depth. If we fear heights, we are blind to the humility vast perspectives bring. If we fear spiders, we are blind to the splendor and danger of webs. If we fear small spaces, we're blind to the secrets of sudden solitude. If we fear passion and involvement, we are blind to the comfort of faith and the awareness of the whole. If we fear change, we're blind to the mystery of life. If we fear death, we're blind to the majesty of the unknown. And since to fear something is thoroughly human, to be blind is unavoidable. It's something we keep struggling to overcome. When we can slow down and move through our fear, we rejoin the elemental force that resides in everything and are empowered with a sense of original energy that reveals our gift. Such energy enabled a poor, blind, orphan teenager to find his gift and live his own life. I'm referring to Ray Charles, who remarked, "I was born with music inside me. That's the only explanation I know. Music was one of my parts, like my blood. It was a force already within me when I arrived on the scene. It was a necessity for me, like food or water. Music is nothing separate from me. You'd have to remove the music surgically." Regardless of the form this energy takes, We constantly struggle whether to honor the great flow of the universe that empowers our very being, or to fulfill our roles as prescribed by others. And while managing both can be done with a rare combination of skill and circumstance, more often the effort to live what is expected blocks the flow of being we seek. After going deaf in 1792, the Spanish painter Francisco Goya understood this. As André Malraux explains, to allow his genius to become apparent to himself, it was necessary that he should dare to give up aiming to please. The mystic Thomas Merton terms this the quest for integrity. Many poets are not poets for the same reason that many religious men are not saints. They never succeed in being themselves. They never get around to being the particular poet or the particular monk they're intended to be by God. They never become the person or the artist who is called for by all the circumstances of their individual lives. So first there is the struggle to ignite what we are born with, which often requires withdrawing from the pulse of the crowd and all its demands. But we are more than a collection of skillful hermits. Our bond to others is as necessary to our well-being as our solitude is for inner knowing. As the psychologist John Bowlby says, intimate attachments to other human beings are the hub around which a person's life revolves. From these intimate attachments, a person draws their strength and enjoyment of life, and through what we contribute, we give strength and enjoyment to others. It seems in living our life we're continually seeking the essence of relationship, of self to world, of self to other, of self to self, of self to the indescribable sum of these, including the unnameable gradations of relationship, in between which others have called God, Atman, Cosmos, Tao. It's not enough to stay off unwanted influence. For while we journey alone, we're not the only ones on the journey. And while each journey is unique, we all journey over common ground. We all come from and feed off the same center. So it must follow. If we are to verify our own experience, we must honor each other's. In the midst of his waterfall of genius, Mozart composed a very unique piece of music called the Table Duet. He wrote one set of notes on a single page, which could be read and played from either direction, from top to bottom or bottom to top. Read from the top down, one tune was revealed, and if read from the opposite direction, the bottom up, another tune was revealed. With the single sheet of music placed flat between two facing pianos, one player would read the page as right side up, while the other would read a different tune from what they perceived as right side up. Yet the same notes read from the opposite vantage points would create a duet when played together. Isn't this the paradox of true relationship? Isn't this the duet that earnest lovers ultimately play? Aren't we, in the dynamic of true intimacy, facing instruments butting up against each other? Isn't life an endless flow of moments that move between us like notes on the same page? Don't we experience the same things differently? Don't I, always in my innocence and in my adherence to my own perception, play back what happens to you upside down? Don't you, in all sincerity, play my joys and pains in a way that seems to reverse my intentions and reactions? Yet don't we play the same events, thoughts, and feelings together? Don't we, despite our struggles to be understood or understanding, don't we play the Table Duet? Don't we, through love, eventually understand each other? Don't we, through deep listening, turn noise into music? Don't we, by adding our voice, complete each other's story? So who will live your life in relationship? If all we do is aim to please, we abdicate our capacity as a facing instrument and merely echo the stronger voice among us. Unable to withstand this struggle, many lovers either mirror their dominant partners or live alone. As in intimacy, so too in society, many citizens either abdicate their individuality by mirroring the wants of their culture, or they withdraw into a self-imposed exile, living as a hidden warrior in a land of conformity. Often we experience our quest for personal truth and intimate attachment as opposing drives. For each human being, in pursuit of what it means to be alive, finds and climbs their mountain again and again, like Moses, not sure what they'll find going up or coming back down. Yet in this journey into consciousness, into experience, into meaning, and back to where we live, in this endless sojourn of exploration and return, lies the test of our human greatness. For the masters in love and art, whoever you think they are such because they do not cease to climb and seldom fail to bring the climb home. And each trip takes longer by virtue of our growth. The longer the climb, the farther and more arduous the journey down and back. One reason the mystical poet William Blake is not fully understood is that he stopped coming back. By the prophetic books, he turned and kept climbing, never to return. In contrast, Wordsworth and Emerson spent more time at the foot of the mountain harking than climbing, which in part explains their attraction to Coleridge and Thoreau, who always stayed on the uninhabited side of the climb. Truly, the task of human love is not to give up our exploration or our return. It seems the truth of relationship burns as the fire of our immersion in that pilgrimage back and forth, from solitude to community, from spirit to flesh, from intuition to tradition. True relationship marks a kind of immersion into life we both crave and fear. After a lifetime of loving, it never ceases to surprise me how the act of relationship, like inquiry or honest thought, looks so treacherous before beginning, and so inevitable, like gravity, once on the other side. But on this side, each of us is a blind climber looking for others while listening for the birds along the way. How often I've watched the geese discover one by one how hard it is to fly alone, how in the crisp October air they start to form their moving V, because each in aerial wake is boosted by the lift of the one before, and how the lead goose pumps the hardest till he tires and drops to the end where he can coast as another takes the lead. I watch this community of birds share the flight majestically. I wonder why I don't even know my neighbor's name. Yet if we dare to act in true relation, if we dare not to rush, not to live any faster than we are ignited from within, if we dare to slow into true presence the many times we do rush, if we dare to hear each other's needs, if we dare to accept the discomfort of not knowing what to do until it becomes the comfort of a perennial question, we might find that one life in its unmitigated fullness may be more than enough. We might find, as the Taoist sage Chuang Tzu suggests, that hiding in itself is a great drain until we dare to live in our own skin. You think you do right to hide little things in big ones, and yet they get away from you. But if you were to hide the world in the world so that nothing could get away, this would be the final reality of the constancy of things. Throughout our lives, we struggle with the temporary ease of hiding and the pain of never surfacing, hiding our feelings of insignificance in our ambitions for a life of fame, hiding our confusions at the complexities of life in principles we hope will swallow them, hiding our pain of honest suffering in a resignation that stills the heart. And all the while, our experience of what is real gets away from us. But if we were to hide who we are in who we are, like hiding a body in its skin, if we were to let things be and not make over their impact on us, all hiding would evaporate, and the constancy of ourself would be final, real, and unequivocal in its majesty of flaws. When we can manage to live our own life, letting nothing real slip away, the larger ocean of life draws us with a magnetism all its own, the way a fish is drawn by light to a surface it can't imagine.